I am Abu.
The podcaster? We have never seen your like here before.
I'm feeling an uncontrollable urge to cleanse this podcast. Draw your microphone or take your hand off of it.
It's not a real microphone, only for decoration. But we have real microphones, even Neumann's. They are kept locked in the display cases to preserve them.
As they should be. Neumann's are pricey.
Neumann's are great.
They are great, though. Wonderful
mics. This is a Neumann.
Ooh. That's wonderful. That's why your voice sounds like liquid gold being poured straight into my ear canal.
I think that's a way of killing people in like the Aztecian. Yeah. Yeah, and actually, when I'm in person, I'm like, hi, my name's Leo! And then I turn on the microphone.
It's the Neumann filter.
Oh,
that...
hello. Yeah.
That'll do it. Get yourself a Neumann if you're trying to podcast.
Don't.
It's so pricey. Don't pay that.
Yeah.
Buy a cheap mic.
How to get started in podcasting. Buy a $1,300 microphone. Step one.
Yeah.
It'll pay off, we promise.
Don't do that for sure.
Welcome to Gom Jabbar, your guide to the iconic world of Dune. We'll be exploring the themes, philosophies, and characters found in the sandy depths of this vast universe. From Frank Herbert's groundbreaking novels to the adaptations on film and TV. My name is Leo.
And my name is Abu.
Oh my gosh, and Abu, are we still reading God Emperor of Dune?
We're still out here. If we were lost at sea, we'd be dead.
We'd also be the ship and the sea, I think, according to recent takeaways.
So true. Yes, we're still out here. We're still continuing our deep dive adventure through the pages of God Emperor of Dune, y'all.
We've come so far. Remember, this is the book that had beef swelling.
Correct.
This is the book that had mouth flaps. We had face dancers and a naked Duncan Gola. We had...
That's right.
Gosh.
So much. Lest you forget, a man swung a wolf around with his bare hand at the start of this book.
Wu-Tang!
Wu-Tang! Put some respect on his name!
God damn, Wu-Tang was so cool. He was the main character.
Truly.
And died in the third page.
Yeah.
Well, before we talk about anything else, let's just quickly get through some housekeeping. As usual, today, no spoilers beyond the pages and the books that we've covered thus far. So... listen, if you somehow accidentally hit play on this episode and you were like a Wu-Tang stan, I'm sorry, he dies.
Yeah, spoiler.
But on like page 5, so like, come on, read the first 6 pages.
Now, of course, a huge shout out at the top of the show to our Kwisatz Haderach level patron, Case Aiken.
Case,
we would put your name right next to Wu-Tang's. on the list of people we love and aspire to be, you're right up there with Wu-Tang.
Wu-Tang, number 2. Case Aiken, number 1.
Number 1, baby. Case, thank you so much for your generosity and for your support. That thank you, of course, extends to all of our patrons who listen and support us and help make this show possible. We genuinely could not do this without you.
It's true. Thank you so much. So, y'all know the game plan for today's episode. Hey, you wrote y'all with the right apostrophe.
I'm learning.
Later on, you did not. I saw later in the script. Fascinating.
I'm realizing I do that interchangeably. I text in that way. I Slack at work in that way. I clearly just don't know how to spell y'all.
It's a lot of letters. It's true. Well, y'all know the game plan for today's episode. We're going to start off with a summary of the chapters that we assigned for the reading. And then we're going to dive into a big old takeaway. Mm-hmm. Today's got one takeaway. It's dense. And then we'll wrap up on a couple of delicious spice morsels. But before we do that, we're going to take a quick break. So don't go anywhere. Seal your fucking mouth flap. Swing that wolf around. We'll be right back in just a few minutes to talk about our chapters.
Wow. You just gave me some new dirty talk to try in bed there.
Hey, babe, I'm going to swing the wolf around today.
How about you go ahead and seal that mouth flap?
Oh, yeah. put on some handcuffs, seal the mouth flap. We're swinging wolves tonight, baby.
Hello, Quotag. Welcome back, everyone. Let's dive into our chapters for today. And today we're starting off with chapter 43.
What a good chapter.
What a great chapter. In this one, we are with Moneo as he is once again quaking in his boots during a meeting with the God Emperor. We've been in this position many times throughout the book.
Yep.
This time, though, he's quaking because Leto is actually reprimanding him for sending Siona and Duncan to Tuono Village without consulting him.
Right.
Recall that he took this action in the last chapter in an attempt to protect his daughter and even to protect the Gola from doing something stupid at the wedding ceremony.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting is there's more nuance here. Leto isn't just mad, why didn't you check in with me before doing this? He's more disappointed in Moneo, because Moneo is standing here shaking in his boots, rather than standing by his decision.
Yeah, right.
And it's clear throughout this whole chapter, actually, that the God Emperor is in some sort of unstable emotional state these days. Like, he's not feeling himself. And it really has very little to do with Moneo's actions. Like, this is low on the priority list for Leto.
Yeah.
Quote, "You have amused me, but take no heart from that. Lately, I cannot separate the comic from the sad." End quote.
Girl, same. Man, that is relatable.
It is. We've all been there. As you're saying, this is a relatable feeling. This feeling of sort of anxiety is something that many of us might be familiar with and that many of us have probably experienced at some point in our lives. And Leto is here experiencing it now.
Right. You know, I had the thought just now. It's funny, thinking about Moneo saying to Duncan at the end of that last chapter, "I'm trying to, like, protect you, and I've never done that before."
Right.
And that the air and the sort of presence and confidence that Moneo kind of controlled that room of, like, you two need to stop fucking up, I'm taking control, I'm doing all of this. I think you're totally right in this summary of, like, that's exactly what Leto's like, hey, that's pretty good. That's pretty solid.
Right.
I like that in you. And now he's just trembling and scared, even though in the past when he was trembling and scared, it was like, because the worm is about to arrive and there's all these like twitching signs and his death is imminent, all that. None of that's here. So there really is, it is this like new stage in their relationship in a lot of ways.
Yeah, definitely. And like you said, Moneo here is not being sort of confident and taking control like he did with Duncan and Siona. And that's kind of what Leto is mad at him about, right? He's like, Moneo, you gotta have faith in yourself, buddy. Stand up for yourself.
Yeah.
Stand by your independent decision that you made, right? A decision you make so rarely because you're so subservient to me. Stand by that, motherfucker. And Moneo's just like, please forgive me. Oh my God, I'm so sorry.
I fucked up. I shouldn't have made a decision by myself.
I'm so sorry. And like we're saying, Moneo, ever the good servant, honestly is having like a tough time wrapping his mind around what he's being yelled at for. And Leto tries to explain. He says, quote, "Small souls who seek power over others first destroy the faith those others might have in themselves," end quote.
Oh, a banger of a quote.
Incredible. It's a great quote. Such a good quote. And obviously, sort of stepping out of the story, this once again feels like a classic commentary on tyrants and politicians and power-hungry leaders and charismatic leaders by Frank/Leto, right? A classic political, philosophical idea throughout this book. And this explanation is finally what sort of breaks through to Moneo, and it has a profound effect on him. Quote, "The words were shattering to Moneo. He sensed accusation in them. Confession." End quote. And I think it's that last sentence that's so important. Accusation and confession. Because Leto, yes, is sort of like unloading on Moneo in the moment, but perhaps what he's really doing is venting some of that self-hatred that we've seen sprinkled throughout the whole book now. Because think about it, Leto is doing the very thing that quote-unquote small souls do.
Yeah,
he is destroying his followers' faith in themselves. And the proof of that is literally standing right in front of him, shaking in his fucking boots.
Yeah.
And that is so triggering to Leto, right? He's like, God damn it, dude. You're just like, you're not the humanity we need to survive.
Yeah. It also gives more depth to the mistake he made when he threw himself into battle to fight the face dancers who were attacking right. the Ixian embassy. Because that realization of they know that I'll jump into battle, they don't have to believe in themselves as like independent fighters. Yeah, it's all this kind of through line.
Mm-hmm.
I also, just on an interpersonal level, you think about like manipulative, like controlling, abusive people do that all the time. They say they like undermine your ability. It's, you know, there's a lot of joking in the modern vernacular about gaslighting, but that idea of being like, no, you can't trust your own senses, so you have to trust mine. And then on a macro scale, oh, I don't know, you can't interpret that book by yourself. You need me to tell you what it's all about. And it's like, oh, cool.
Yeah.
I guess I'll go through you to understand God.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
Totally. That's a wonderful point because, yeah, like on an interpersonal human-to-human level, we see that kind of manipulation in abusive relationships or, you know, abusive friendships or anything like that. But we also see it on a grander scale when it comes to institutions or people claiming to have all the answers when in reality they don't. And all they're doing is crushing their followers' ability to have independent thought and belief in themselves. Which is clearly an idea that Frank / Leto value highly.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is religious institutions are abusive boyfriends. So that's just making that clear.
In case that went over some folks' heads, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay, back to our chapter summary here. The conversation then turns toward wedding arrangements. And we get confirmation of something that we've actually suspected for quite a few chapters now. There is unrest among the fish speakers because they feel at best uncomfortable with this marriage and at worst, like they feel slighted by it and perhaps even betrayed and hostile.
Right.
Quote, the fish speakers are disturbed because I called them my brides and now they see a stranger not trained in Sihanouk who knows it better than they. End quote.
Yeah.
And that perhaps is the source of the fish speaker anxiety. This outsider has come in and is suddenly closer to our Lord than we've ever been able to be.
Yeah.
Now, Moneo, for his part, is still confused and overwhelmed throughout this conversation. He keeps asking for forgiveness, and he kind of breaks down when Leto's like, bro, grow a spine, stand up for yourself, do it. And Moneo's just like, I can't, I'm sorry. He like kind of has a breakdown. And Leto knows this, right? He immediately backs off. Leto's like, okay, I'm sorry, I pushed you too far. Moneo is the blind, loyal servant that Leto created himself. And Leto, in the moment that Moneo sort of has this break, realizes he's pushing this person too far. This person is not capable of becoming someone like Siona, or even someone like Duncan.
Right.
Now, after soothing the majordomo, Leto's like, okay, let's return to the thing that this guy knows best, which is taking care of business. So they get back to the business of wedding planning, and he declares that there's going to be a couple of last-minute changes. Firstly, we're going to switch the water rings from Ganema's to Chani's. Sorry about that. Can you actually go get it? Her body's over there. And also, I don't know if you booked the venue yet or anything, Moneo, but I want to do it in Tuono Village. Thanks, buddy.
So disrespectful. And so fucking... Because again, you just think about this from Moneo's perspective. He goes, I'm going to send them to safety away from the God Emperor.
Right.
And Leto, this whole chapter is leaving him on edge. He's feeling so anxious. He's feeling so antsy. Leto's like, wow, that was so independent. What a good job on that. Hey, listen, honestly, I'm not even mad. Pretty good. All right, last bit of business. We're moving the wedding to that fucking village, dude.
Oh my gosh. Like, the whiplash.
Also, yeah, by the way, yeah, go dig up my mom's body. Use her jewelry. What?
Incredible.
It's okay. I'll talk to her in her voice. So, you know, it's okay.
Yeah, it's wild. And I do feel for Moneo in this moment because, my God, you have to book wedding venues so in advance. How is he going to change that shit last minute? It's wild. Poor guy's suddenly got a couple of all-nighters ahead of him because of these last-minute requests.
Dude, his therapist is going to hear about this for sure. Okay, well, our second chapter today is chapter 44.
Mm-hmm.
We join Siona and Duncan as they are welcomed to the sparkling metropolis, Tomono Village. Mm. And their first impression of this sparkling hub of civilization, this shining example of architecture and Fremen culture, not a good one. Because, folks, Tomono Village fucking sucks. It's just awful. It's terrible. Every detail we get is dripping with just gross detail. It's just sad. It's depressing. And this is one of the saddest chapters.
Right. It's every Holiday Inn you've seen off the side of the freeway.
Oh, God. Yeah. They say continental breakfast, and it's two bagels wrapped in plastic that were made in the 40s, the 1940s. Exactly. You're like, glad I got that for breakfast.
Mm, radiation poisoning.
Just like me at a Holiday Inn off the interstate, Duncan is disgusted by what he sees. He's disgusted and offended, doubly so because it's not just a shitty Holiday Inn. It's a shitty Holiday Inn that's like, we are proud Fremen.
Yeah.
Like, we are proud, true Fremen. And these are kind of the only remnants of Fremen people, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Siona's alongside him just being combative and annoying.
Yep, classic.
Typical. Now, they're greeted by a delegation of Museum Fremen, led by their heavily sarcastic, air quotes, name, Garun, and a crowd of children holding shitty flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it wasn't clear yet to the reader how disgusted Duncan is by all of this, consider this little excerpt about the kids. Quote, children were pressing forward around the delegation, extending clumps of garish red flowers in their grimy hands. The flowers were wilted.
Amazing. Quote. Amazing.
So not only are these garish clumps of flowers, not beautiful bouquets, no. Garish clumps of flowers, grimy hands, and the flowers are fucking wilted.
My God.
Delightful. What a great metaphor, a subtle metaphor for how far the Fremen people have fallen from their glory days.
Yeah, right? Truly, truly.
Now, our takeaway today is going to be about the Museum Fremen. We had heard a lot about them throughout the book, and now we're really seeing the itty-gritty details.
Yeah.
Nitty-gritty details. So we're going to move on with the chapter, but we'll come back to the Museum Fremen and the takeaways later.
Right.
Now, Garun is chatting with Nayla and Siona. And Duncan's like, fuck this. This is a boring conversation. I'm going to wander. So he walks around, and he just gets more and more grossed out the whole time. He's like, this kind of sucks. It's kind of like the first time you go to Times Square in New York.
Yeah.
At first, you're like, wow. And then the longer you spend in that area, you're just like, this is perhaps the worst of humanity. Right.
There's so much pee. How could there be so much pee?
It's more pee than the people who live in New York could generate. That's why we have to fly tourists in to generate pee. Now, Duncan is noting lots of little details, right? He notes Garun's brown robes are just an imitation of the real Fremen thing.
Right.
Basically the same as his shitty fake stillsuit. And they're all like weirdly tight. All of the Fremen robes are too tight because they just don't have a lot of fabric. And it means that they can't even move well in the robes. So what might have been a way to maybe conceal a Chris knife or, you know, keep your body hidden and to protect your stillsuit is now this like weird, like I think of like a straitjacket from an insane asylum, right? Like something that's restricting movement. And what a metaphor that is for someone like the Fremen.
Right.
And, of course, He, in examining Garun up close and personal, Garun is offended, puts his hand on the hilt of his fake-ass knife.
Oh my god, this poser.
Which is so stupid, because, of course, you're right in front of Duncan motherfucking Idaho.
Right.
And although Siona could twist him into a pretzel, that doesn't mean everybody in this galaxy could. So, absurd. And Duncan hates this place. I mean, again, just kind of taking a step back.
Uh-huh.
We are given every reason that Duncan has for disliking this place and being offended by this place. Quote, Idaho felt himself almost overcome with the desire to cleanse this place.
Oh my God.
Even if it cost him his life, end quote. We have someone who's like, you know, historically has been like, I will only lay my life down for my own ends and for the Atreides. And here he's just like, this place sucks so bad, I would give my life
right
to wipe it off the
map. If I eradicated these people?
What if I killed everyone?
Is a real thought that Duncan has in this moment.
Yeah.
Wild.
Yeah. Well, on that delightful note, the chapter ends as Siona grows bored of this back and forth. And she's like, you know what? Just take us to her fucking room. Nayla has to step in and kind of awkwardly like, oh, gosh, okay, here's the thing. We're at this Holiday Inn off the interstate.
Uh-huh.
We have a single twin bed for the two of you.
Oh, my God.
It's a small room, and there's a single twin bed. Just so you know, it's the orders. I can't go back on them.
Right.
And, of course, Siona kind of shoots a look to Duncan. She's like, remember what we talked about? Duncan's like, I'm going to do whatever I fucking please with my hands, and none of it has anything to do with you.
Right.
Like,
as I've made clear
many times. So not interested in you.
Yeah.
She's like, cool. Good, good, good. And as they leave, and in the final lines of this chapter, we get one more example of how kind of gaudy and weird the Museum Fremen are.
Yeah.
Garun, the noble name of this village, siege? Like,
of this Holiday Inn.
Like, of this Holiday Inn, the name of Holiday Inn, kind of like coyly winks at Duncan, like, ah, you're sleeping in the same room as
that.
Oh, oh. Hey, oh, look at you. I already heard you were a womanizer.
Yep.
And Duncan's like, I fucking hate that. Should I cleanse them? I settled that for myself, but maybe I should revisit the idea.
Yeah. So slimy. So slimy.
Yeah.
It is funny because I've joked in previous episodes of this book club that we get these very silly rom-com moments throughout the book, right? We get that meet cute early in the book where Siona and Duncan are in the ornithopter it swerves like and she like falls into him and touches his chest and realizes how big and broad his shoulders are.
Yeah.
This right here, arriving at a hotel, only having one room booked with one bedroom,
is a
classic rom-com trope. It is a classic for the folks out there who read like smutty or even just like rom-com novels, romance novels. This is a classic trope that you're very familiar with. Two people end up in an unfortunate situation of having to either share a bed or be stuck being stuck in one bedroom, whatever. And I just found that so funny that in this like deeply dense science fiction fantasy speculative book full of politics and philosophy, there are these little moments of like rom-com silliness. Like we have a straight up enemies to lovers stuck in one hotel room plotline happening right here.
Yeah.
And, you know, who knew? Frank Herbert, bit of a romance novel writer himself.
Yeah. He went on to write Friends, three seasons of Friends. Yeah.
What? That's not true, right?
No.
Okay. That's a joke. Okay.
Yeah. He died.
I don't know anything about Friends.
20 years before.
Okay.
That would be pretty wild, though.
That would
just be halfway through an episode, Joey is like, you know, Ross, I've always thought about religious institutions. The golden path. Holy shit.
Oh, what the fuck? His eyes turn. He takes his contacts out. His eyes turn blue.
Oh, my God. Joey's been spice addicted this whole time.
Holy
what a
shit.
Tonal shift for this New York-based
This is now
sitcom.
Heretics of Dune. All right. Well, on that note, that wraps up our chapter summaries for today. Two fairly straightforward and quick chapters. Let's take a breather, though. But don't go anywhere, folks, because when we come back, we are going to dive deep into the Museum Fremen. So stick around.
Welcome back, everybody. Hope you swung a wolf. Let's talk about our takeaways today, and specifically, let's talk about the Museum Fremen. Mm-hmm. We learned quite a bit about the Museum Fremen in today's reading. So, yeah, let's take some time. Let's break down what we know and maybe theorize why. Why Museum Fremen? Why?
Exactly.
And to start off, this moment that Duncan arrives at the village is just so full of so many details.
Right.
And we see just how pathetic everything is. Quote, a tattered green banner fluttered from a metal pole atop the largest structure. A fitful breeze brought the smell of garbage
oh my God.
And uncovered cesspools to Idaho's nostrils.
Ugh.
End quote. Wait, is this about Times Square? I feel like
it's
that
gotta be.
Last sentence is just exactly Times Square.
Yeah, it's gotta be.
But everything, right? Tattered banner. It's a metal pole. I feel like every choice that Frank could have made about word choice is just bringing it all down, right? Degrading, degrading, degrading. There's no glory here. This is a tattered banner, and it's in the Atreides green.
Yeah.
It's symbolic. All of this is symbolic of the sorry state of the Fremen, this group of people who were so great. And even the people inhabiting this village, Tuono Village, are just shadows of Fremen cosplaying, basically dressing up like in their Halloween costume, Halloween store. What's the spirit Halloween costume?
Yeah,
$29.95 adult male extra large Fremen costumes. Even Garun himself is a young man. The Nabe is a young man. Very strange. Not like a battle-wizened person who earned the spot through trial by combat.
Right.
He's a young man with fucking normal brown eyes.
Oh my God.
No eyes of a bad. There's no spice addiction here. He's just a dude. He's just a fella.
Just a normal ass dude wearing his sexy Nabe costume that he got from Party City or whatever.
Excuse me, the garter belt is accurate to how Fremen dressed, okay? The high heels are important for walking without rhythm.
Absolutely. The thigh-high socks? Stilgar never left home without them.
Yeah. I like this name.
Now, regardless of how high the socks may or may not be, one of the saddest things about these Museum Fremen is the commercialization and cheapening of the culture. It's something that Idaho notices in the children that greet him, right? Quote, Garun spoke to Idaho. If you give them a few coins, they will not bother you. Idaho shuddered. Was this the training for Fremen children? End quote.
Yeah, that's so depressing.
To beg for coin.
Yeah.
How far the Fremen children have fallen. And we did a little bit of digging in the encyclopedia, which expands further on this idea about how Fremen culture has been commercialized. It talks about how around all of these villages, vendor stands would pop up, and these vendors would be selling, quote, plastic Chris knives and maker hooks clearly stamped with their planet of manufacture, Giddy Prime.
I fucking knew it.
Stuffed toys in the shape of sandworms, siege models to be cut out and assembled, steel-suited dolls, all were available to the tourist desiring a souvenir, but not worried much about its authenticity. End quote. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I just want to say, for all of you, all of the people who own the IP for all this stuff, I would 100% buy siege models to be cut out and assembled.
I
guarantee it.
Like, I would too, to be fair.
I mean, listen, and if you added like a manufactured and Giddy Prime like stamp, that'd be kind of hot. That'd be kind of cool. But it doesn't belong in a Fremen village. And it doesn't belong, like, this is the shit that you expect to find on the you know, the town platform where, you know, St. Ollie of the Knife is about to give her speech, and you have these like bustling, you know, merch stores.
Yeah. Yeah. It honestly reminds me of a trip to Japan I took a while back now, maybe 5 years ago. And I remember going to what I had looked up was like a sacred temple. I forget exactly which one it was, perhaps like the oldest temple in Tokyo or something.
Yeah.
And I remember going there and being excited for it, and then immediately being let down because as soon as you arrive at the gates, it's literally the temple off in the distance, and then just rows of hundreds of merch stalls and vendors just selling like the most touristy, like keychains and shit.
Yeah.
You know, little replicas of the temple. Like I was so turned off by it, and it just felt, you know, I don't know. I was just a tourist there, but I was like, damn, I came to this temple to like experience some history and to see this incredible structure for myself and maybe learn something about it. And instead I'm just being sold like fucking plush toys on the sidewalk.
Yeah. I had the same feeling about like Venice. Like I went to Italy for the first time last year, and I went to a few of the big cities, like, you know, Florence and Venice and San Gimignano and a few little cities. And Venice was just like kind of awful, because the whole time there are people trying to sell me shit and be like, get on the gondola. And I'm like, I don't want to get on the gondola. Fuck you. You know? And
right.
And then I'm also from New York, and I've been in New York a long time. So people would come up to me and I would just say no and then walk away. So it's brutal, because part of it is these things pop up because of supply and demand. It's funny because I do think about your experience reminds me of someone who might come to a pilgrimage to Arakeen or to Arrakis to experience the genuine belief of or the reverence for the Holy Family and for the Messiah and for Muad'Dib.
Right. Maybe get a glimpse of Muad'Dib on the balcony off in the distance.
Right. And yet you have these like families who are like, we're going to bring the kids. We're going to bring the kids to Arakeen. And then the kids are like, daddy, I want maker hooks with like the plastic Giddy Prime stamp on them.
Right.
So it's funny because you're right. It's like, this is obviously sci-fi. This is a book, but this is very much modeling what happens in the real world, where there is this supply and demand. People want to buy the shitty little keychains. They wouldn't be selling them there if no one ever bought them.
Of course.
But it is hard, because I'm in a similar boat. I would, you know, do whatever things need to be done to protect the space, but I would also love to walk among the pillars and that things. And I know that that could never be an option, because kids would be fucking drawing with markers on the pillars and, you know, things would immediately go to shit. So
absolutely.
It's hard. It's hard to balance that stuff. And we're seeing that balance not being preserved on Arrakis, on this planet.
It's this capitalist tug and pull between preservation and authenticity versus commercialization. And we see which way the Fremen people have fallen in this instance. One other example I wanted to quickly point out is that Duncan even looks, he like sort of peers in the window of the green flagged topped building, and he notices a stage in there and some seating and some carpets and some pillows or whatever. And he instantly realizes that this is not a place of ceremony as it used to be in the old siege. This is a place of entertainment where these museum Fremen put on shows and pseudo rituals for the delight of tourists.
Yeah. Literally, Garun says, will you wish a performance of our Fremen rituals? The music, perhaps?
Oh my God.
The dance?
We wrote a musical. We hired Lin-Manuel Miranda to write a musical about the Fremen, starring Stilgar.
Yeah. And it's just exactly Moana. Stilgar is like, I've been staring at another.
Right. Oh my God. Who does The Rock play in that case?
I mean, probably Duncan Idaho.
Oh, right? Of course. You're right. The Rock plays Duncan Idaho in the musical.
Charismatic, yeah.
Yeah. I would watch Dune the musical, to be totally fair.
Oh, 100% fucking percent. We'll talk about that in another episode. But yeah, the idea of like Fremen rituals as performance is just one of the most upsetting and offensive combination of words.
Yeah.
Because you think about like what rituals were there, where it's like water rings, it's funeral rites, it's reclaiming water. It's like so much of it's life and death. So much of it is built out of necessity.
Right.
In the difficulty of living in the sands of Arrakis. And the idea of like, would you like us to perform? It's disgusting. It's so gross.
It is. It almost makes you want to cleanse.
Cleanse. Yeah, yeah. Call me Mr. Clean because I'm about to go on a cleansing spree.
Okay, so all of this ultimately leads to a big question, an existential question about the Museum Fremen. Why? Why would Leto preserve these people or allow them to degenerate to such a state, right? They're his people. He is Fremen.
Yeah.
Why would he allow this to happen?
And to point out quickly, because at first I was like, did he preserve them? But you have to realize he straight up banned Mentats. He was like, hey, that whole school and that way of life, no more of those.
Right.
It is very clearly the case that he is picking and choosing, and he did not choose to say no more of this Fremen impersonation bullshit, or even he didn't create a second Sarir, for instance, to preserve actual fucking Fremen out in the desert somewhere. His Sarir is huge. I forget how big it is.
Mm-hmm.
He could have people there. Doesn't.
He doesn't. He could do so many things, right? He is in ultimate control of this universe.
Yeah.
He's out here being like, nah, I guess I'll keep the Ixians around for another couple generations. I thought about eradicating the Bene Gesserit, but not today.
Yeah.
And here we are, the Museum Fremen are in this sorry state.
Maybe a second desert planet.
Anything.
And then just, yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
So many ideas. We're popping off ideas right now. Leto, borrow any of them.
Yeah.
But again, the question leads back to why. Why did he do this? And in the encyclopedia, in the Dune Encyclopedia, the historians posit two very different theories. So in brief, theory number one is that Leto maybe planned one day to restore Arrakis back to a complete desert planet, and thus he was just sort of maintaining the Fremen in this like sad, sorry, frozen state to eventually turn them back into the Fremen of old so they could reclaim Arrakis and kind of turn back the clock, turn it back to Dune, as we knew from the first book. That's right. Theory number one. Theory number two is that a very lonely and very sad Leto, who has spent thousands of years longing for his life as a normal human boy living among the Fremen, his longing for that is why he has sort of kept these people around and not let them die out and not eradicated them. He's keeping them around in this state purely for nostalgic reasons, so that at least some part of that culture is alive and well somewhere on the planet. That's theory number two.
Yeah.
Now, both of these theories do have some level of merit, but the encyclopedia is clear that neither has been confirmed beyond the shadow of a doubt, and it seems that Leto himself never explained his reasons for the Museum Fremen anywhere in his journals or in any of the discoveries at Dar es Balat.
Yeah, it's hard. I, you know, given as familiar as we are with the Dune universe, you would think there would be kind of a prevalent idea of why they're preserved. And I'm sure, you know, our Discord channel will be abuzz with conversations about this. And absolutely, I encourage it. I think be interested to hear what people have to say. You know, part of me thinks that, like with everything, the Museum Fremen are, you know, I don't get the sense that anybody takes them seriously. Anybody in the galaxy.
Agreed.
And if you're looking at the oral tradition, the oral history, and you're saying, you mean the Fremen fucking ruled the universe through their might as warriors? And then you see the Museum Fremen trying to shove their like wilted flowers in your face, asking for a couple of coins.
Yeah.
My sort of personal theory is probably more along the lines of like, as much as it pains him to see the people that he grew up among degenerated to this state, this sorry state, it's an important message for people, the universe, about I don't know, just it yeah. about change, about it, like Leto's peace is Leto's peace, but it's not necessarily a good thing. And him being in charge, you need to have like data points that say, oh, this last 3,500 years has kind of been a shitty thing. And look at Muad'Dib's own people are now beggars in the streets. Was he really a god emperor? You know? So maybe these are seeds that need to be present for that time that he, you know, goes back to. Because you're right. It's like, I don't know, for the idea that these Fremen could even reclaim the desert, I don't believe they're more capable than the fucking fish speakers. The fish speakers are out here with like incredible physical prowess. I'm like, yeah, they've got the knowledge. I don't know. It seems unlikely. So part of me thinks this is just a very complex seed that is supposed to kind of burrow its way into the universal consciousness. And down the road, maybe 1,000 years from now, it'll be something that blossoms into like a lesson that is important for the Golden Path or something. Yeah. I don't know.
I think that's a great theory. I agree that almost everything Leto does and has done for the last 3,000 years ties into the Golden Path in some way, shape, or form, big or small.
Yeah.
And for the Museum Fremen to still be around, even in this pathetic form, there must be a reason and there must be a lesson, because so much of what Leto is doing is teaching humanity the ultimate lesson they will never forget, a lesson they will learn in their bones. And I agree. I think there is something to be said about, look at these once great people and look how far they have fallen. Perhaps the lesson there is something we've heard many times throughout Dune. Nothing is infinite, right? On the scale of infinity, everything is just a blip in history.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So the once great Fremen were once great, but they can't be great forever because nothing is forever. There's also a potential lesson there about hubris, right? To rise to such heights, to rise to such fervor as to unleash a jihad. There is risk in that. Look what that does to your culture and to your people to do such a thing.
Yeah.
That's a potential lesson in there too. So I really like where you're going with that thinking. There must be a lesson here within the Museum Fremen for humanity to learn. And perhaps they are an example of that lesson.
Yeah. And they're really, it's true that Leto does everything for a reason, but also Frank includes these things for reasons. And I think this is also continues to reinforce that you cannot interpret Muad'Dib and Leto as saviors of the Fremen, as outsiders who came in and saved the Fremen, right? Like, this is the period on the story of the Fremen in a lot of ways.
Right.
You know, they've really fallen far, and maybe that's all they need to be. Maybe this is just the before and after picture of what happens to a people when they fall into the hands of a savior. Like, maybe this is the ultimate punctuation on that thesis of what happens when a messiah takes over and leads a culture to take control of everything. Well, they're doomed.
There you go. You know? Case and point.
Case and point.
Here's your plushy sandworm. Get the fuck out of my face, kid.
Yeah. Aren't you happy?
Aren't you happy
it came this far?
Yeah.
Go look at the knives in the display case. They're probably also fake.
Now, regardless of which of these theories are true, I'm sure it's a mix of, you know, column A, column B, column C, even. We do want to make clear one thing. The Fremen culture sort of falling apart and degenerating was not directly Leto's doing, to be fair. He cannot be held accountable for that entirely. It was already happening by the time of Children of Dune, if you'll think back to those book club episodes, right?
Yeah, true.
And the Dune Encyclopedia gives us some really interesting details on the decline of the Fremen people, both as a culture and as a military might. And I'm going to read this long quote, but it's so good. The encyclopedia puts it quite bluntly. Quote, "The Fremen army that swept through the empire during Paul's jihad was, 100 years later, a broken reed, top-heavy with bureaucrats, dependent on local support, and often manned by sick and unwilling conscripts. Had it not been for Leto's spice-based stranglehold on the Spacing Guild and his consequent absolute monopoly on transportation and communication, the Fremen army could not have secured a single planet against a determined resistance after about 10,260, let alone have held the Empire together. End quote.
That's incredible. What an analysis. Yeah.
We are 3,000 years later in somewhere hovering in the 13,000s AG. In 10,260, the Fremen military might and the Fremen culture had already started to degrade so much that it's unlikely that they could have won a single battle on a single planet like they did during the height of the Jihad. So a lot of it is Paul's fault. A lot of it is the Bene Gesserit's fault. A lot of it is the ecological transformation of their home planet and the loss of Omtal and the loss of their traditions. So many of these forces came together to make the Fremen what we now see them as, the Museum Fremen. And we can't say that all of it is Leto's fault. Could he have prevented it? Certainly. He kind of let it happen. And we've theorized a couple of reasons why he would have done so.
Yeah, that paragraph also really shows how hollow some of the power is. Like, realistically, people weren't challenging Muad'Dib's reign, and they weren't challenging Leto's reign because they were like God ordained on a pedestal, you know.
Yeah.
So, like, could not have secured a single planet against a determined resistance after about 10,260. So that's like 70 years after Dune happened. Yeah, that's pretty early on. There were probably still pockets of resistance that, according to this, could have taken a planet but didn't try because of Muad'Dib and because of the allure of that sort of bravura. I don't know.
Yes. The mysticism of it all, right? Like, yeah, who are we to fight against God? Certainly. Like, this makes it clear, which is really interesting because it's not something we pick up directly in the books. We just assume he must have, like, the strongest military in the galaxy, so no one's trying to challenge him. This makes it clear he did once have the strongest military for a couple of decades, and then it was not the strongest military in the galaxy. And what helped Paul and the Atreides and that whole government structure of the Fremen maintain and retain power is religion and not military. Very interesting stuff. But there you have it. There is a bit of a conversation, some theories, and a deep dive into the Museum Fremen as we meet them in this book. A lot of interesting ideas there that are very much in line with the big themes of the Dune saga. So this was a fun one to dig into.
Yeah, and absolutely. In our Discord, in the God Emperor of Dune book club channel, I'd love to hear other theories too. So for sure, we can have a conversation about that. Interested to hear what people have to say.
Definitely. Okay, well, let's take one more breather, folks. But don't go anywhere. Hope you're hungry. Get your plates, get your silverware, because Spice Morsels are coming up next after a short break. We'll see you in just a minute.
Welcome back, everybody. Hope you enjoyed your break. Let's dig in to our Spice Morsels. And our first Spice Morsel today, water rings.
Mm.
Now, on a very basic level, water rings acted as counters for the amount of water released by a dead body, and they were like usually won in combat. For example, Paul versus Jameis.
Right.
But also, according to the Dune Encyclopedia, quote, the rings possessed great social significance above and beyond their representation of water. In Fremen betrothal, the would-be groom presented his water rings to his fiancée. She would then arrange them on fine wires to be worn either as earring or, more commonly, as hair ornaments. End quote.
Wow. Romantic. Yeah.
Very sweet. Yeah. It's just, here's some $100 bills, and then she kind of sticks cables through them and wears them as necklaces.
Love it.
Very cool. I mean, again, this is all very analogous to, you know, using gold as coinage and then also jewelry and also as like adorning.
Sort of. Exactly.
Now, the rings also served a role in dating and family life. Important for you young Fremen out there looking to score a date.
Right.
An important note here. If you want to get married as a young man, You have to own rings. You have to have water rings.
Have to.
So just as a side note, if you're like a little bit of like a dual averse Fremen, you don't deserve to be married.
That's right.
What are you doing? Trying to have a life partner. Ew. Kill someone already. What are you doing?
Right. Wow. You're not a lover or a fighter. You have to be a lover and a fighter.
Guaranteed. Yeah. And again, I imagine there are other ways you could be like given or like, or, you know, if you saved a Fremen, another Fremen, like a fellow Fremen in the water, maybe they give each other to pay you my water debt, things like that. I'm sure there are ways people earned rings from one another.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But if you're not out of here like doing that, fuck out of here. You're single forever, dude.
Single forever, man. Yeah.
And this system basically ensured that weaklings or outcasts could never father children.
Wow.
which is wild. That is a type of dating Amtal that we've joked about, but is now confirmed.
Yeah. Brutal. Brutal.
Now, water rings also played a role after marriage because a man was only allowed to give his rings to one woman and could not split them.
Oh.
So, let's say, you spent your time well, killed a bunch of dudes, have a bunch of water rings. You're like, all right, I'm getting married. This is great. You give your water rings to your betrothed, wears them in her hair. Lovely.
Lovely.
But if you wanted a second wife, because that's allowed in Fremen culture, you want a second wife, you can't go, oh, hey, babe, can I get like 10 of those rings back? Because there's another girl that I've kind of been flirting with and like... Yeah. No,
Penny, babe. Leah has been giving me eyes. Babe, please.
I got her to 10 hearts recently. I think it's time I give her my watering.
Have you seen her paintings?
Have you seen her wood sculptures by the lake house that she lives in? Man, for those of you who play Stardew Valley and also like Dune, You're eating well tonight.
That's right. Yeah. All two of you.
All two of you. That's us. So, yes. If this hypothetical Fremen wanted a second wife, he would have to go earn more rings, which is, you know, fair.
Fair.
Again, you don't want to give your betrothed two rings and be like, oh, actually, babe, please. Now, circling back to Chani and Ganima's rings, it is worth noting that these were not won in combat by these powerful women.
Yeah.
Fremen culture, as lovely and wonderful as it is, did not allow women to perform ritual combat. And any rings obtained by killing an enemy were given to the tribe's reverend mother.
Ooh, patriarchy strikes again.
Patriarchy strikes again. Yeah. So we have to assume that Chani's rings were the ones given as gifts from Paul. So, which is then interesting, because these are actually the same water rings that Jameis had. Like, these are the Jameis water rings.
Yeah, passed
down. Because they're the ones that earned by Paul, given to Chani, et cetera, et cetera.
That's right.
And then Ganima's rings were given by Leto. So, at some point, Leto killed some folk, earned some rings, and then were given to Ganima.
Right, because of their, like, pharaonic brother-sister wedding that they did at the end of Children of Dune.
Political marriage. Yeah. So very interesting. And again, draws an interesting connection. These rings being dug out of Chani's crypt off of the remains of her body are almost certainly the same water rings that Paul earned from killing Jameis. And going back to the whole dating thing, this again is why it was so funny for Paul to be like, oh, girl that I've just met, can you
hold these, please?
Can you hold these for me? Hey.
And she's
Hey, beautiful. You want to hold these rings for me? She's like, oh my God. He's like, why? Did I stutter? Anyway.
Yeah.
Paul point. Charisma Riz Muad'Dib.
Indeed. Alrighty, let's continue talking about the Fremen a bit more. This is a very Fremen heavy episode. Our second morsel today is about Fremen clothing. So we talked earlier about how Duncan observes Garun and the other museum Fremen and how they're wearing what appear at first glance to be authentic Fremen robes of dark brown. But upon closer inspection, he notes a quote, tightness in it dictated by a need to conserve fabric, end quote. And of course, this tightness, as we discussed earlier, doesn't allow for freedom of movement or the ability to hide things within your robes like a true Fremen might need to fight and survive out in the deep desert. They are more fashion than practical.
Right.
Now, the Dune Encyclopedia, when you dive into it, goes into great detail about Fremen clothing, all of which we do not have the time to cover in today's episode. We'll have to tackle it more fully in another episode dedicated to Fremen culture. So for now, in this morsel, let's focus on what's relevant to Duncan's observations about the robes and the clothing.
Right.
So first, we're told in the Dune Encyclopedia that imported cotton was the most common material for Fremen clothing, followed in second place by wool, which was also imported because, lo and behold, there are no sheep in the deep desert.
Right.
Now, while there aren't a lot of details in the Dune Encyclopedia about the robes themselves, we are told that casual wear, something they'd wear just around the siege or at home for men, was apparently quite colorful back in the day. Men favored tones of yellow or blue or green or crimson underneath their robes and underneath their stillsuits.
Yeah.
On the other hand, women preferred more neutral earth tones like sand-colored tan or brown or beige.
Right.
We're also told that men and women most commonly wore loose trousers and heelless slippers, and then often paired that with a cloak made of wool on top. But regardless of whether you were a guy Fremen or a lady Fremen, there's one thing that was true for all articles of clothing. Quote, all of the clothing of both sexes made changing into stillsuit quick and easy. All these articles of dress added insulation from the sun and the drying winds of Arrakis, end quote.
Yeah, yeah.
And that kind of leads back to the idea we were mentioning earlier about practicality versus fashion. These articles of clothing that the Fremen wore, they might be colorful, they might be made of nice material like wool or cotton, but they were, at their very core, practical. They made it easy to slip into a stillsuit. They protected you from the dangers of the deep desert. Now, based on what we know about the Museum Fremen and all that we've talked about in our takeaway today, I personally highly doubt that their clothing was as practical or made of as high quality material, considering they're out here skimping on material and making their robes tighter and not as flowy. So it's clear to me that the material and the quality and the practicality of the old Fremen garb is not what Duncan Idaho is seeing here on the Museum Fremen. It is a pale, pale imitation. It is cheap material. It is impractical for true survival out in the deep desert. And I know for certain, that Garun found that fucking cloak in the bargain bin.
Oh, guaranteed. Oh, my God. He went on to ebay.arrakis.com and he was like, authentic Fremen robe. And then it was not even, but he was like, oh, I don't think they'll notice.
Oh, man.
Hopefully no Golas come around. Duncan shows up. Oh, shit. Oh,
son of a bitch.
God damn it. Wasted that money.
Yeah, definitely. So there's a little bit about Fremen clothing for you. Again, that is just a tiny taste of what's in the encyclopedia, so we'll certainly have to revisit some of these Fremen cultural details in a future episode.
Indeed we will. Okay, and that's another book club in the bag. A little bit of a shorter episode, but hey, we were just looking ahead and we've got some, oh my God.
Oh, we got some juicy ones ahead, folks. Yeah.
Some juicy ones ahead. So for our next episode, and hey, for patrons, that's going to be in the new year. So happy new year.
Yeah.
For the next episode, make sure you've read chapters 45 and 46, or if your book is a different edition than the one we have, read until the chapter that ends on the sentence, quote, Garun may be wiser than any of us, she said, end quote.
Bullshit.
Bullshit. He's not. fucking calling it now. Can't even remember what that's about. Guaranteed he's not.
Oh, man. Well, before we let you go, as always, a couple of quick reminders here at the end of the show on how to support us and keep in touch, starting with the two best ways to support this show. One, become a patron at patreon.com/comjabar. Ad-free episodes, invitation to the Discord where you can chat with us, lots of other cool bonuses. And two, check out our merch store at comjabarshop.com. We have a lot of Dune-themed swag. Get yourself something nice. Get your loved ones something even nicer. All of those links will be in the show notes.
Indeed they will. And finally, we love to hear from you. So, hey, email us, gomjabarpodcast@gmail.com.
Yes.
What a weird email. Send us your thoughts, your questions, your theories about why the Museum Fremen, period.
Yeah.
Why? Why them? Why even? Why even Museum Fremen? !
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then, of course, pictures of cute pets, because we always say yes to the cute pets.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, that rounds out today's book club episode. But as we said earlier, for the patrons listening to this early, it is the end of 2023. We are heading into the holiday season. So for those of you listening early, we just want to wish you a safe and relaxing holiday and end of year. You and I, Leah, will also be taking a much deserved break. We take no breaks throughout the year, to be clear. This is the only time we don't work on Gamjabar is these final 2 weeks of the year. So we're going to rest, recuperate, and gear up for what should be a wild 2024 that includes a little-known movie called Dune Part 2 by Denis Villeneuve.
Oh, my God. Is that the one with Kuteg?
I hope it's the one with Kuteg. If I don't see a wolf getting spun around by its tail in this movie,
yeah,
we riot.
I want to see a man fight wolves with a wolf. Yeah, but seriously, everybody, happy New Year. And yeah, can't wait to get back. And actually, in a full transparency, I'll probably still work on stuff the next 2 years. I've been wanting to like make new merch designs and it's just so much stuff to work on. But
yeah, that's
fun.
True. It's true. But we enjoy it.
We do.
All right, y'all. Patrons, we'll see you next year in 2024. To everyone else, we'll see you in the next book club.
Well, friends, there is no real ending. It's just the place where you stop the recording. But this podcast is always one step beyond logic, so help spread the word of Muad'Dib and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And be sure to check out the other shows on the Lore Party Podcast Network on loreparty.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at lore_party. We're also on TikTok at Gamjabar Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, whoever controls the podcast controls the universe. We'll see you on the Golden Path.